acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 57, Wunderkammer, Wednesday, October 15th, 2014. I'm your host, Sarah, podcasting from Yinhu Chaiwan, Silver Lake Tea House. Show notes for this episode can be found on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The show has a Facebook page and is available on iTunes. This episode contains the following segments: ever-expanding skill set, the back porch, a little bit of learning, and yarn lover at large. This week, I'd like to welcome new listener Polkadot Knits, who has been a lively member of Ravelry Conversation and has also made several comments about my posts on Instagram. In particular, we've been talking about getting unplugged and taking a break from technology and our personal thresholds for screen time and digital media and other kinds of interaction. Being an introvert, even engagement in social media tends to tax me a little bit, and I enjoy my time being unplugged. And I'm very lucky to have a partner who shares some of those same parameters. So we see eye to eye on those things a lot of the time. I think it can be difficult to negotiate that sometimes if you spend time with people who have a different threshold for social media and screen time than you do. One of the things I'm excited about at Rhinebeck this weekend is the opportunity to just be among people and be social media free for a day. And some people complain a little bit about the cell phone reception and the interconnectivity that you can get at the Dutchess County Fairgrounds. I think it's great that those things don't work very well. It makes me feel less guilty for not checking them or looking at my phone. So I'm excited about that. Skill set. This week I have been working on a recipe for some seeded crackers. This will be a gluten-free recipe, and I still have quite a bit of work to do. I've tried a blend of a couple of different recipes, and I am working toward coming up with something of my own that I hope you will think is delicious and nutritious and really a lot of fun, and makes probably the best use of the bulk bins at my local health food store than any other recipe I've developed so far. I don't have it ready for this episode, but I have been releasing new recipes for the bulk bins cook-along as blog posts so that they appear on their own on my blog. There's also a link to a page on the Yarns at Yinhu website where there are thumbnail photographs of each recipe I've developed, and you can click on that and go directly to either the episode where that recipe is typed up, that's in my earlier recipes, or more recently, it will take you directly to the blog post. And the blog post contains only the recipe. I like that technique a lot more, and that's what I'll be using in the future. So you should see this recipe pop up maybe on Saturday, Maybe I will consolidate my ideas for a seeded cracker recipe on Saturday. I've also been expanding my skill set this week by teaching my first fiber arts kind of course at the Inner Space in Highland Park, New Jersey. And the title of this course was Beginning Spindling. It was for folks who have no experience with spindles, and it turned out that my participants, three of them, did have some experience with yarn and other fiber crafts, but not with spindling. So they were extraordinary participants in the workshop, and I was really happy that what I had planned was what I was able to execute during the 2.5 hours that we had together. In my planning for the workshop, I adhered to one of the 7 habits of highly effective people, which is to begin with the end in mind. And that became a structure for the workshop time as a whole. So we began with a yarn lab, and we dissected 4 different kinds of commercially available yarn. And we examined them for fiber content and number of plies, method of plying, and that allowed me to review a lot of the different vocabulary that I would be using throughout the workshop session. Then we looked at some hand spun and spindle spun examples of yarn and talked about some similarities and differences. And then we examined fiber, and I was so pleased to have some very easy to spin fiber sent to me from Sherry of Spinner's End Farm in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. And she sent me, I examined some of the different things that she sent me, and the one I chose for this class was called Everybody, and it's a mixture of fibers from different animals she has on the farm. It's beautiful gray, but when you look at it, you can see that it's not uniformly gray. The gray is created by a number of different colors and textures of fiber from the animals on the farm. It's very thin, almost pin-drafted roving, not quite that thin, but it's very easy to handle. It's very sticky, and it was a good choice for beginning spindlers. I also gave the participants some rolags to try, and I had made those rolags using, again, some of Sherry's fiber and some other fibers that I had, and my blending board. So they were able to try a couple different types of preps for fiber. Everyone was able to spin some singles and ply them together using a plying ball, and they left with a 2-ply length of yarn, and everyone was pretty excited about what they had created. I'll put a few photographs from our workshop up on the website for you to see, with a link to the Inner Space website. There is still time to register for upcoming workshops. I have 2 sessions of meditative spindling coming up. The first one is on October 28th, and then there's another one in November. And also in November, there is a spinning the chakras class, and that will focus on meditative spindling, but with the added element of using color to increase your enjoyment and your contemplation during a meditative spindling session. And like I said, I'll provide a link so you can check out these workshops and register one if you are interested. The back porch. A few weeks ago, I completed the Planorbis corneus shawl, which is a pattern from Hunter Hammerson's Curiosity Cabinet, Volume 3. I did not talk about it too much in that episode because I knew I wanted to talk not just about the shawl, but about Hunter Hammerson's collection and, to a greater degree, curiosity cabinets. And I knew that would take up quite a bit of time. In fact, that will be the basis for the remainder of this episode, pretty much. And I had this idea before I even began episode one of this podcast. I think I've mentioned in a couple of earlier podcasts that listening to Paula's Knitting Pipeline audio podcast has been an immense motivation for me. And when I first discovered Knitting Pipeline, I only listened to a few of the recent episodes before I went back and started listening to the beginning. If you haven't listened, you must, is the one about the owls. Magical. And I remember Paula saying that she had had that idea in her mind for a long time before she was able to actually put that episode out, because it required some research and a lot of thinking. And that is the case for me. This was on my list of themed episodes from the very beginning when I started brainstorming what would I podcast about. And Hunter Hammerson's use of the curiosity cabinet as inspiration for pattern designs really captured my attention, and I've held it with me ever since. So finally, I was able to complete one of the patterns. Part of my reluctance, I suppose, was a great deal of anxiety about how difficult her patterns are. She also writes a lot of patterns for socks, and I'm not a very motivated sock knitter. So those are not the designs I like, but knitting the socks is not a very big point of interest for me. I was more interested in the other kinds of accessories that accompanied each pair of socks. In volume 3 of the Knitter's Curiosity Cabinet, Hunter Hammerson's inspiration is a series of vintage marine illustrations. The one that inspired Planorbis Corneus Shawl is a variety of freshwater mollusk or snail. I thought this was a beautiful pattern, and I thought it was a good place to start with Hammerson's designs. It was also asymmetrical in design, and that was of interest to me because I began working on this during the asymmetrical craft along and finished shortly after the asymmetrical wrapped up. This is the first time I have knitted lace where there are pattern directions to follow for both the right side and wrong side of the knitting. And that was very challenging, but it was also incredibly satisfying. I selected creatively dyed yarn in the colorway Valencia, which is DK / worsted weight yarn. It's a light worsted. I selected this when I was shopping at Rhinebeck 1 year ago. I liked it because it had 260 yards in 160 gram skein, so it was a pretty hefty output. I liked that. I liked the coloring of the Valencia colorway. It's a lot of rusts and pinks and even yellows and browns and interspersed with bits of white. I knit this with US size 5 needles. And over the time that I was knitting it, I gradually became more confident in my ability to follow the pattern. Much of the knitting is just a repeat of 4 stitches, and I would just replay the mantra of that stitch pattern in my mind as I was knitting. And then the increases happen at the very end of the row. What that does with the Planorbis Corneus shawl is it creates a kind of spiraling motion of the shawl. And when you look at a photograph of it, it looks like the spiral is moving in a right curving or right leaning direction. But when you understand the construction of the shawl and how it's knit, you come to realize that the spiral is actually a left leaning spiral. And that's why I called this project Sinistral in my Ravelry pattern page, because Sinistral has to do with a left leaning spiral. And this is where we get to a little bit of learning and information about different kinds of spirals, and also a little bit more about the Curiosity Cabinet inspiration for Hunter Hammerson's books. In the introduction to The Knitter's Curiosity Cabinet, Volume 3, Hunter Hammerson gives a beautiful overview of the Curiosity Cabinet concept. She writes in the book that she could only put this to paper thinking that no one would ever read it. But I think it's beautifully written, and I would like to share a bit of that with you. And if you're the kind of nerd that I am, I think you will really appreciate it. Curiosity cabinets started in Europe in the late 1400s and early 1500s. This was a period when explorers were off having all sorts of adventures and bringing back never-before-seen wonders from around the world. The rich and powerful men who funded and profited from these explorations began to construct hugely elaborate displays to show off their new treasures. These collections were eclectic in the extreme and organized only by the whims of their owners. Natural objects like fossils, shells, and rocks sat side by side with man-made objects like paintings, statues, and ornaments. Beautiful geodes shared shelf space with skulls and gruesome preserved animals. Mundane items were mixed in with things purporting to be unicorn horns and dragon scales. The collections were meant to be both personal amusements and demonstrations of the power and importance of the people who assembled them. Gradually, over the course of the 1600s and 1700s, the contents and functions of cabinets began to change. Instead of amassing random objects and displaying them in a jumble, collectors began to focus their interest on specific areas, such as flowering plants or English beetles or corals or whatever else caught their fancy, and to arrange their collections in a logical, orderly fashion. This change had everything to do with the development of what we think of as modern science. Cabinets and the objects they held were becoming sites of scientific inquiry, full of instructive specimens rather than mysterious treasures. This reflected a shift in ideas about how people should come to know about the natural world, through the study of the world itself, rather than through reading what ancient experts had to say about a subject. At the same time, ideas about who should assemble cabinets were changing. No longer were they the sole preserve of powerful people. They became hugely popular pastimes with people of all walks of life. Men and women, upper and middle class, formally educated or merely curious, all could enjoy the thrill of collecting, and all could hope to contribute to the growing understanding of the world in which they lived. Cabinets had become a democratic pastime and a scientific tool rather than a display of power. The contents of many of the more extensive cabinets eventually served as the foundation for some of the world's most famous museums. Isn't that beautifully written? I just love it. At the end of that, she says it's shamefully quick, and she invites you, if you're curious, to continue exploring more about curiosity cabinets, which of course I felt invited to do, and I certainly did. And she goes on to explain how, in working on her designs, she wanted to be at first in possession of some of the objects from Curiosity Cabinets, or she wanted to be in possession of some of the original prints that were made of the contents of curiosity cabinets. And these proved to be very difficult to procure and very expensive. And so she ended up working with some collections of books that contained prints inspired by the contents of curiosity cabinets. One in particular was by a Mr. Turton, and its full title is A Manual of the Land and Freshwater Shells of the British Islands, arranged according to the more modern systems of classification and described from perfect specimens in the author's cabinet with colored plates of every species. So she couldn't resist using a source like that. And indeed, in this beautiful book that she has are reprinted some of those pages of prints. They're very beautiful in themselves, and it is easy to see how the print served as the inspiration for the structure of an accessory or the details of a design. And the print for the Planorbis corneus, which was the inspiration for the shawl that I knit, was from that collection of Turton's. In researching a little bit more about Planorbis corneus, I found that the common name for this species is the great ram's horn, and it does bear a resemblance to a ram's horn. It is an air-breathing freshwater snail. It is unusual because it appears to be dextral or right-handed in its coiling of the shell, but it is in fact sinistral or left-handed. Being sinistral or having a left-handed coiling pattern is unusual in itself because 90% of the species have dextral or right coiling shells. This type of snail would be found in ponds, places with still or slow moving water from Europe to Central Asia. And it would often be found among weeds and in places where the water held a high level of calcium. Here's a little bit more of my research about curiosity cabinets in general. They are known by a variety of names. They could be called cabinets of wonder or rooms of wonder. In German, that would be Kunstkammer or Wunderkammer. Indeed, they began as compilations of items arranged in no particular order. And then gradually, as the scientific method and order and structure became the rule of the day, the collectors followed suit with attempts to organize different kinds of materials. There were generally three different kinds of artifacts in a Wunderkammer. They would be Naturalia, or products of nature, Artificialia, or artifacts, the products of man, and Scientifica, the testaments of man's ability to dominate nature. And those would be things such as clocks, automatons, instruments, different kinds of tools. In some cases, the cabinet or room or method of arranging these objects was just as fascinating as the objects themselves. And so whole rooms or very particular kinds of cabinets were constructed to hold and organize the collections. Here's a description from 1565, and it alludes to an arcaded courtyard and a, quote, formation of cloister-like ambulatories with four wings comprising several floors to house nearly 3,500 items. The Dresden Kunstkammer of the Electors of Saxony was called a working collection and had a didactic aim. Its contents were supposed to be a teaching tool to improve the professional skills and stimulate the cultural interests of public visitors. Eventually, there was an entire industry devoted to making the cabinets and the cabinetry for these collections. The cabinet makers of the imperial city of Augsburg specialized in producing this kind of cabinet in the 16th and 17th century, and they delivered them fully furnished with a micro collection that might include hundreds of items. I thought that was kind of interesting that eventually it was more about the display than the act of having collected all of those things. In one of my sources, Collecting for the Kunstkammer, there is a reference that predates the appearance of these curiosity cabinets. It begins, "It had embossed on its surface the entire history of the world and mankind, its wondrousness derived from the cumulative effect of diverse subjects and details, and from the bringing together in one space apparently dissimilar things." And then it goes on, "Thus Homer describes the shield of Achilles, the legendary Greek hero of the Trojan War. This object could have been the keynote piece of a Kunst- und Wunderkammer of the 16th century." However, its description also summarizes the theoretical concept of such rooms, Kunst, art, and marvels, Wunder. The Kunstkammer displayed an encyclopedic collection of all kinds of objects of dissimilar origin and diverse materials on a universal scale. One of the things I love about doing research is finding incredible lists of things. And I'll read to you a little snippet from the Wikipedia article about curiosity cabinets, simply because I love the way the listing technique is used in this paragraph. Two of the most famously described 17th century cabinets were those of Olaus Rumius, who lived from 1588 to 1654, and Athanasius Kircher, who lived from 1602 to 1680. These 17th century cabinets were filled with preserved animals, horns, tusks, skeletons, minerals, as well as other types of equally fascinating man-made objects, sculptures wondrously old, wondrously fine, or wondrously small, clockwork automata, ethnographic specimens from exotic locations. Often they would contain a mix of fact and fiction, including apparently mythical creatures. Wurm's collection contained, for example, what he thought was a Scythian lamb. It was a woolly fern thought to be a plant sheep, fabulous creature. However, he was also responsible for identifying the narwhal's tusk as coming from a whale rather than a unicorn, as most owners of these tusks believed. The specimens displayed were often collected during exploring expeditions and trading voyages. One of the reasons that this idea of the curiosity cabinet so captured my attention and my imagination is that Yinhu Chaiyuan has a version of a curiosity cabinet installed in the downstairs living area. And it was something that Samuel and I spent a lot of time and attention and money restoring when we were working on that portion of the house. The cabinet at Yinhu is about 6 feet long and less than a foot deep, and it contains a number of glass paned doors so that you can see the collection, but there's also a focus on the intricate pane work of the doors, and that imitates the panes of the doors and the windows of the house. I wanted to draw even more attention to this aspect of the house, and so we painted the interior of the cabinet in a deep red color. Actually, not a deep, a bright red color, and then we installed lighting on each of the shelves so that the objects inside would be illuminated. In terms of what's contained in our curiosity cabinet, it's definitely more of the hodgepodge jumble of curious and interesting artifacts arranged in no particular order. I definitely have not used a scientific method to identify anything that should be put in there or to arrange it inside of the cabinet. Mostly it's a collection of things we like, textures that we enjoy, I guess stories or narratives that we want to preserve. Typically, anytime we travel to someplace interesting, we try to bring back something, and it need not be anything that's very expensive or valuable, but just something we like that helps recall that place and that's in keeping with the other objects that are there, things that are interesting. I guess my main concern in organizing the cabinet is to just create it so that what you really want to do is open the door, reach in, and take something out and turn it over in your hands and look at it and wonder at it. We're also very lucky to have friends and family who give us the kind of interesting things that we like and want to place in that cabinet. And there's not a lot of wall or storage or other kinds of decorative space at Yinhu. So pretty much anything we want to display goes into our curiosity cabinet. We also have some special books in there, and we rearrange the contents of the cabinet every once in a while. One of the things I like to do is set up a manger scene in the curiosity cabinet during the holidays, and this keeps it out of the way and dust-free. That's important because the figurines of Mary, Joseph, baby Jesus, and the wise men and a shepherd are beeswax figures. And so it's kind of important that they stay away from dust as much as possible. So I set them up in there, and then in lieu of a manger scene, I just collect all of the little wooden ornaments and animals. Some are wooden, some are stone, just all different kinds of things. And I create a manger scene with crocodiles and lions and elephants and giraffes and all of the different exotic creature figurines that we have. And it's usually a really good conversation starter and a point of interest when we have guests during the holidays. And it's a lot of fun to do. So that's one of the highlights of my year, is setting up that scene in the curiosity cabinet. I wonder whether any Yarns at Yinhu listeners have a cabinet of this description, or have ever seen one, or had their imagination captured by something similar. If that's the case, I would love to hear about it on the Ravelry thread for this episode. So I hope you'll consider chiming in and letting me know, maybe sharing a photograph of something that you have in your home. Like I said, this cabinet is one of my favorite features of Yinhu. It's something I treasure. I'm so happy for all of the hours of labor and careful work that we put into restoring it and making it what it is, because it's always a source of pleasure. Especially in the winter months when we spend more time inside and it tends to be, you know, kind of dark and dreary and cold, I feel like this curiosity cabinet lends some warmth and light and interest to the room. You can kind of escape into the world of the curiosity cabinet by looking at it for a long time. Yarn lover at large. This weekend is the New York Sheep and Wool Festival in Rhinebeck, New York. Or as Malia Jackson refers to it, Knitter's Prom. And I'm very excited that I will be going to Knitter's Prom on Sunday. I will arrive nice and early and I plan to spend the entire day there. I'm looking forward to doing a little bit of shopping, but mostly seeing people that I know and meeting people that I don't. In particular, I hope to meet any listeners of Yarns at Yinhu that might be there. And I will attend the Ravelry meetup / podcaster meetup that happens in the middle of the day. I will be there. I can be identified by my Yarns at Yinhu field bag, which contains the logo for the podcast and was lovingly designed and printed for me on this beautiful field bag by Samuel. And I will also be wearing, barring any apocalyptic interference, I will be wearing the Dixon cabled skirt designed by Nora Gaughan. This is knit in a lichen green heathered cascade yarn and has a gorgeous all-over cable pattern. I am on row 84 and I need to reach row 92 of the cable pattern and then 2 inches of 2x2 ribbing before I bind off. That is completely within my reach. And in trying on the skirt, I'm not sure how flattering it is, but the length and the fit are just fine. In fact, I'm pretty pleased with them, and I'm looking forward to kind of putting it together in an outfit. I've never had a knitted skirt before, so I didn't think very carefully about how to wear it. The weather for Sunday looks to be quite cool. And so a knitted skirt will look and feel appropriate for the weather. So I am excited about that and eager to be finished with this project and enjoying some time at the Sheep and Wool Festival this weekend. I'd like to leave you with a quote. This is from the essayist Montaigne. In my opinion, the most ordinary things, the most common and familiar, if we could see them in their true light, would turn out to be the grandest miracles of nature and the most marvelous examples, especially as regards the subject of the action of men.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. Music for this episode is So Weak. Music and lyrics by Samuel like St. Thomas, performed by Chris DeLong and Cesar Diaz.
River bends like an
if you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider liking the show's Facebook page or leaving a rating or a review on iTunes. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set
this week. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. just like Linda Cousins, but I don't wire. It's a subway nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Nature's ever get you high till your face is smile. Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a subway nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature.